This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. As you know, we built the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
And this week we spend a lot of time talking about the king of fish.
Or as my father would put it, reed fish. Good morning, I'm Mark Stephen, and right beside me here at Beechgrove in Aberdeen, Rachel Stewart.
Yeah, what a lovely morning it is, actually, isn't it? It's really quite mild.
It's actually not bad.
Yeah.
6-7 degrees, something like that.
And yeah. It's not too windy, so actually
not too windy,
very
it's
pleasant.
It's not snowing, look on the bright side.
Yeah, we're not doing any whinging this morning. Do let us know what your plans are this morning. Will you be out and about enjoying the countryside? outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is our email address. 80295 is the text number, or you can give us a ring on 0808 592 9500.
The days are definitely getting longer at the moment. My wife and I came in from doing the horses last night about, must have been, I mean, we both looked at the kitchen clock and went, wow, it's 5:45.
Mm-hmm.
But there was enough light to see outside to do stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is stretching out and it's getting lighter earlier in the mornings.
It definitely is. And as you say, at the other end of the day as well, I was out last night about the same time, 5:45, 6 o'clock-ish, and there was loads of geese going over the top of our house, huge numbers of them. And I looked up and there was still just a little bit of light in the sky.
Yeah. But definitely having slightly better weather does have an effect on you, just in your mood.
Yeah,
how
I
you
think
feel.
That's right. Yeah. Now, the moment you've been waiting for, shall we have today's first blast of the mystery sound?
That's a good one.
It is a good one. Yeah. If you know what it is, do send your guesses in. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is the email address. Text us 80295 and give us a ring, 0808 592 9500. I think it's Alex here manning the calls this morning.
Absolutely.
He likes a blether.
He does like a blether. This time of year is when most of the Scottish rivers actually open up for the salmon fishing season and things. Right now, I mean, it runs usually till about the end of October. The River Devon runs through Aberdeenshire and Banffshire, and I went along to the opening of the Devon season at Turriff earlier this week. Richie Miller is from the Devon District Salmon Fishery Board.
The river's in good condition. It's a nice height, a little tinge of colour, sun's shining. So fingers crossed for the season ahead.
What was last season like?
Last year was challenging, there's no doubt about it. We had about 2 months of low water, which really meant that the fish that did come in the river was mostly down the bottom end and didn't sort of distribute through the river. So really for an 8 week period, the anglers were up against it.
Could they fish at all?
Yeah, they could fish in the evenings when the water temperature was lower, so that there was no stress to the fish, etc. But over the 9 month period, it was quite challenging.
I am genuinely thrilled and honoured to do this. As a little misfit boy from the jungle of Borneo, I came here when I was 11. My dad would come fishing to these places, and I feel incredibly proud to be somewhere so beautiful and to be asked to do this. To all of you, tight lines. Yay. Oh, no.
It's feast or famine. I mean, you had 8 weeks there where you had very little water.
Yeah.
Over the last couple of months, we've had more water than we knew what to do with. What does that do to the river?
That's right. So I came to this river in 2007, and I think this is one of the wettest winters that we've had. We've not had any major floods yet in terms of the doing damage to the riverbed, but we are concerned with the wetter winters that this can remove the reds from the bottom of the river and cause destruction to the salmon eggs.
Just describe a red to me. What is it?
So basically a salmon red is a nest. So it's where the female lays the eggs, the male fertilises, and they sit there over the winter, and then the fish hatch in the spring.
They can hatch thousands of eggs, but it's a hugely wasteful process. Of those thousands of eggs, only a very, very small percentage actually get to maturity, get out to sea and come back again.
That's right. So a salmon can lay 1,200 eggs per kilo of a body weight. So, you know, that's obviously an 8-pound fish, for example, can
about 5,000 eggs.
Yes. So and as you say, a small percentage make it through to hatching. Then they leave the river after 2 years, and then they return from sea after or 1 or 2 years. And 30-odd years ago, maybe around 25 to 30% made it back from the sea. Now, unfortunately, it's more like 3%.
I'm Jim Ross, been a gillie in the Devon for 24 years.
What's your take on the future of fishing in the Devon?
It's very difficult to say. The way the numbers are going, I would say this is the crunch year. I think they had 750 fish last year. They had 950 the year before, so there's it goes in a 5-year cycle. And we're hoping that last year was a really bad year. This year, if they get 900 or 1,000, then you'll say it was. But if this year's 750 or less, then it's not looking good.
Why do you think it's happening?
It's everything. Pollution, vermin.
What do you describe as vermin?
Well, your goosanders and your cormorants. There's not any seals in the river because there's nothing for them to eat now. But cormorants and goosanders are the biggest problem. And you're not allowed to shoot them because they're protected. You get a licence for so much, but...
About a month ago, Atlantic salmon were put on the endangered species list. Why is there still fishing at all, if that's the case?
You need fishing to put the money in to look after them. It's a catch-22 situation. If you've no fishers, you've no revenue, and then you're really finished. It's the fishers that actually are saving the fish, although it doesn't sound that way.
And how do you feel about the fact that it's in such decline?
It's heartbreaking, really. I mean, to say I've been a countryman all my days, and to see this happening in front of you, I mean, seemingly you can't do anything about it. It's unbelievable. But the trouble is, even though they manage to revive the fishing within the next 5 to 10 years, there'll hardly be any fishers left. It's very dangerous looking.
Just as we're walking down here, what's your name and how long have you been fishing this river?
My name's Lambert McTavish. I'm the Vice President of the Turf Angling Association, and I've been fishing this river since I was a boy, 14-year-old, but I've been in the club here for 30 years now.
Mm. How has it changed? How has the river changed in that time, Lambert?
It's changed because, climate change has a lot to do with it. What we're noticing is that the runs of sea trout and salmon and everything seems to be coming later nowadays than compared to what it used to be. Big salmon don't seem to be coming in at when they usually do. It seems to be come down in November when the season's closed and you'll still see fresh salmon coming in. I think sea temperature's up about 0.5 degree. It doesn't sound much, but it does have a detrimental effect on salmon and how they react in their runs, etc. So, we do notice a big change.
Yeah. But if you are, if you're seeing runs of bigger fish in November and... You know, you're actually closing the season in October. That must be really frustrating.
It is frustrating, but on the other hand, you're saying at least the salmon and it is coming in through up in November. And at least they're getting a chance to, on their reed beds, to, you know, to lay their eggs and things. But this year, especially since September last year, the amount of rain and high waters we've had can have a big effect on the salmon laying their eggs, etc. So you're always hoping to have a steady flow of water, not 10 feet and 12 feet, etc., because that can ruin the eggs that's been laid already. So
we've had terrible amounts of rain in this area recently. What effect does that have on the salmon stock when you get these sudden, really aggressive rises and then falls?
If you get a big rise and it falls quick, you can have a walk down the riverbank and you'll see hundreds, maybe thousands of small salmon par lying dead because the river drops so quick nowadays. It can be 12 feet maybe in the morning and by lunchtime it could be back down to 3 feet. It drops so quick, but it goes up so quick nowadays because of the drainage and the farmers and everything have nowadays. Years ago, it would take days for the river to rise and weeks for it to drop.
So you think that the drainage the farmers has got is too effective?
Yeah,
it's getting rid of the water too fast.
And then if you're cutting down forest trees and things like this, and not enough trees being planted on the hills, then water's coming off the hills at such a speed. You know, the rivers just seem to go up so quick, it's unbelievable some days. You can actually stand and look at a river rising right in front of your eyes. It's quite something to see.
Big philosophical question. Why are you a fisherman?
A good point. I think about that myself.
It sounds impossible. Why bother doing it?
I think in the earlier days, I was more keen on going out and catching and a fish, and I love the sport. But it's not just about the fishing. It's meeting many different people on the riverbank. It's being in amongst nature, a beautiful morning like it is today. And it's really just being on the water, and there's many anglers I know that sometimes don't even set up their rod for the first few
Seriously?
Hours. Yeah, that's it.
They just sit there with a thermos flask and enjoy it.
Yes, that's it.
How beautiful is the River Devon?
For me, I think it's a stunning river. As you can see here today, the frost, the sun shining on the water, the birds singing. As you move through the Rothiemay Valley on that high point there, looking down, it's a beautiful, beautiful sight as you drive along, and then as you head down through Netherdale and as it enters the sea at Banff, I think it's wonderful.
Richie Miller of the Devon District Salmon Fishery Board, and we also heard from John Beattie, who opened the season. Nice to catch up with John. Gilly Jim Ross and angler Lambert McTavish. And we will go back later in the programme to the Devon to hear about two historical catches really on the river.
Yeah, they're really interesting, and that is a very beautiful spot that Richie was talking about as well. That whole stretch is stunning, I know it well. You do wonder what's going to happen, don't you? You heard the Gilly there saying it's a crunch year. It feels like every year a crunch year when it comes to Atlantic salmon.
But there is a definite trend, you know, with these things, and there's so much working against it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. As I said, I was surprised when the Atlantic salmon were put on the endangered species list, because anything in the endangered species list, how? I mean, I've no feelings on this either way, but I would be sad to see fishing go, but how can fishing continue for a species that's on an endangered species list, even with catch and release?
But then they would argue that, you know, the anglers, the eyes and the ears of the river,
yeah,
without
well
their money, you can't do all this work that's taking place in all of the rivers across Scotland just now to try to improve things for the salmon.
A friend of mine years ago gave me a book, and it was a compilation of stories from a magazine called Trout and Salmon. I thought, why are you giving me this? Really? Some of the finest natural history writing I've ever read was in that book.
Mm.
You know, I mean, just these people stand and watch and remember and can compute, and you know, and they can draw comparisons. It's worth listening to them.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. They've got huge knowledge.
Mm.
We're kind of sticking with fishing, but slightly different angle here. The word fishwife can have some pretty negative connotations.
Not in my house.
Not. But the women who worked as fishwives in Scotland were largely very savvy, with colourful personalities. Unlike those who were employed in the herring industry, fishwives worked for themselves, and they often walked huge distances selling their wares directly to the public right up to the 1980s. Their role is the subject of a new exhibition at the Scottish Fisheries Museum in Anstruther, and I asked Jen Gordon and Julia Branch why they decided to call it Yellow Butterflies. We haven't actually got many records of this, but it's kind of hearsay that this was a kind of term used to describe the fishwives, particularly in New Haven in Edinburgh, because of their colourful costumes, which are like red and white stripes or yellow and white stripes.
You've actually got one of the costumes on display here, and they definitely are colourful. So one has got a yellow skirt, a really bright red, very attractive shawl, and a cream shirt. It's probably not the drab costume that you'd expect someone involved in the fishing industry to be wearing.
No, so it's a blouse rather than a shirt, just to correct you on that. But basically, they were very proud about kind of like how they dressed.
So they would be going into the fish market, they would be picking up the fish, they would be gutting the fish, but they also were saleswomen and their identity was an important part of that. So that's why I think you have a costume that is so distinctive, and that's where the yellow butterflies come from, the yellow stripes that were featured in Fisher Row. You have fishwives in other parts of the country, so up the north east coast, that would go into Aberdeen to sell fish rather than Edinburgh, which is where the south of the Firth fishwives went. And they weren't known quite so much for having quite as bright clothes. That was more of a kind of Fisher Row distinction.
Also, kind of the costume, there were elements that you would find with fishwives across Scotland, so like a bonnet, an apron, a skirt and the blouse, but they also had slight distinctions geographically, like different ways of folding their petticoats or aprons that were very distinctive to the different areas of Scotland as well. So you'll see we've got some tiny dolls that are on display here that actually look at some of those different variations of the costume.
And apparently the blouses or the wrappers that they were sometimes called, very delicate, pretty patterns, some of them white with lace, and apparently some families had their own lace patterns within that, within lace work, were like distinctive family patterns.
So they were obviously very proud of this.
Definitely, it's a heritage that you live through and learn from your family. It was very rare for a fisherman to marry out with the fishing community because they needed someone that could hit the ground running with skills like collecting the mussels, number one, scooping them out and putting them on the bait, on the line, the long lines that were used to catch whitefish. And then you had to have the skill to know what sort of fish you wanted from the market, what was going to sell to your customers, and obviously to be able to fillet that perfectly to keep your reputation up when you went to the city and keep your customers happy and with the fish that they wanted.
And they were colourful characters as well, because they needed to have the gift of the gab, didn't they, in order to sell their wares?
Yeah, they did. They needed to be able to sell fish because, you know, fish starts to go off as soon as you get out of the water. You want to sell it as quickly as possible. And that means that you try to be the loudest mouth person at market or wherever you're selling your wares, because you need to sell your fish as quickly as possible because the price will drop down. So this is kind of why there's this character and this reputation of the fishwife as being a really loud person, but she had to be.
Yeah, sometimes they are, or they were known for having quite harsh tongues. Is that a fair description?
Well, we don't know for sure. I mean, I'm sure within the atmosphere of a city market, yes, they'd have to be heard. But when some of the fishwives would work in little teams, groups of three, or sometimes what was called as a syndicate of six. So when they went to the market, apparently it was described by one fishwife as being bedlam. So they had to get in there and make sure they got the fish and that they could sort out between the six of them to go and sell. But once they were, I guess, in a city, if their area was residential areas, they'd have no need to be shouting, really, and they would politely go and speak to the lady of the house or whoever was purchasing the fish from them. So there was another side to them. And, of course, many of them were, their Sundays were focused around church, and they were kind of God-fearing women. So I think a lot of them probably could be perfectly polite women. They were known as, they're very much ladies, proud of their appearance and their costumes. So I don't think necessarily any of them were rough in any way. They were just really strong. They had to be physically strong women, and they had to be confident to sell their wares.
There's a reference to one fisherwife who actually, like, in her pocket, she had, like, her small knife
for doing some of the work with the fish, but she also had a really long knife to kind of protect herself from any dangers on the street. And I kind of like that idea of, like, okay, maybe they did have to be a bit fearsome if they were, like, in big urban cities, because they were women going around by themselves.
So they had to protect themselves. And probably some of this reputation, as you say, is a bit unfair because, you know, you do hear things like, you know, don't be an old fishwife. Mm. You know, don't be a big gossip. That's basically what that means, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think, obviously, you know, Fisherow was a very separate part of Musselburgh and it was all the fishing community there. And so they would have had a way of talking to each other that might be quite intimidating to outsiders. It might seem a bit like gossipy, but they were known to be very resilient and very cheerful. A lot of singing involved. Sports seemed to be very sporty. The Musselburgh Fisher women played golf long before it was popular among other women in Scottish society. And they'd have a football match between the married and the unmarried fishwives. They were quite athletic and, like, yeah, dancing and sports was always part of kind of gala days. And so that there was a sportingness to them, that, and of course gossip, because everybody gossips, but probably no more than any other group in society, really, when they all get together. And they probably had a riotous laugh. I've heard about two old fishwives apparently rolling about on the floor, remembering, roaring with laughter, remembering about stuff that happened to them on their adventures, because, I mean, they really had so much independence. And apparently they never said how much they made, and they kept whatever money they made to themselves, and were quite enterprising. They seem quite different. I think that's why their legacies lived on. It's, you know, that they are quite a distinctive group.
And that exhibition, Yellow Butterflies, runs until the 18th of March at the Scottish Fisheries Museum in Anstruther. You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. She's Rachel Stewart. Coming up, life on the island of Ulva, 6 years on from the buyout.
And we've got today's mystery sound.
Combination squeaky door and donkey.
Yeah, I think squeaky door. We've had some guesses in already.
Indeed. David John Chadwick and Carl Luke says, good morning. As it's likely to be dry enough, we'll be travelling to Lanark to walk the dogs around the loch and racecourse. I've been told water rail and mergansers have been seen in the loch this week. Last week's sound was a real test. I think this morning's mystery sound is not a zebra, it's a donkey. Brackets, maybe.
I like that, yeah. David and Leven says, two boats tied together by rubber tyres. Craig and Bearsden, is the mystery sound a cow at a barn door opening a jar? Like
and
it.
Stan Brumelow says, I think it's the angelic sound of a donkey braying.
Good morning, Mark and Rachel. It's a lovely fresh morning in Rothes. Reggie the Labrador has already been out for his first walk of the day. Good going. Denise says, the mystery sound is the wooden padlock box I keep my wallet in, opening for the first time this year. We'll be off for our regular River Spey walk and paddle after the programme before the fishers start for the day. And that's Denise and Phil.
It's a good mystery sound. And
you can get in touch with us outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text us 80295, or give Alex a ring on 0808 529500 if you want to have a guess.
We were just saying earlier that it's milder today, it's calmer today, it's drier today. You know, all of this helps and contributes, which was something I was thinking about earlier this week. This caught my eye. It's just a bit of broken hawthorn. It's beside the old railway line on the Buchan and Fermarton Way. And the branch has been down a while, obviously. But it's covered in lichen. And it's really quite beautiful. Some of it's a sort of a light pastel green. Some of it's much more sort of emerald. And some of it is pretty near yellow. And then the bark itself, which you can see, is sort of really dark reddish brown, almost a mahogany colour. And where I am, there's a reasonable view. I can see the proper Icy across there, which is just outside Haddo Estate, near Tarvis. It glorifies some Earl of Gordon or other, I think, or Aberdeen or something of the kind. And the other side, I can see rolling farmland and lots of wind turbines. And unusually, they're just going round and no more at the moment. Really sort of lazy movement. I have had, there's an old Scottish word, I've had this week a sort of fusionless week. I did a couple of days' work and then I had 3 days off. Now, I had a list of stuff to do as long as your arm. and I could not be bothered doing any of it. None of it. I just could not work up any sort of energy or enthusiasm to get started, and every time I tried forcing myself to do it, it simply didn't work. This morning, I got up completely different. Now, maybe something to do with the fact that I had a bad chest cold for a while. The weather was bad, it was freezing conditions, you know, it was icy, you weren't going to go out on your bike then, it just would have been too dangerous. This morning, it was calm, there was a hint of blue sky, it wasn't raining, or not initially, it wasn't raining anyway. And I just felt completely different. Now, why am I sharing this with the group? Well, we've done quite a few things recently on seasonal affective disorder, and how the weather actually influences not just your mood, but your body, how it operates. And I've broadcast all that, I've listened to all that. In my head, I knew all that, and I don't think I put two and two together. I think that's what was wrong with me. I needed a wee bit of better weather to feel better and re-establish some gumption. So today, got up, did the horses, pumped up the bike tires, and I've cycled along the old rail line, as I said. Now, most of it is fine. See, when you get to the hill going down to Ellen, there's been a lot of water going down there, and it's really carved a gully out. At one stage, I went through what I thought was quite a small puddle. It was about 20 feet long. It was about 20 feet long. Sadly, it was about a foot and a half deep in the middle, so my feet are soaking wet. And then I stopped in the cafe in Ellen to get a cup of coffee, and I thought, I better take off my waterproof jacket and my fluorescent waistcoat and all that kind of stuff. Thank goodness I did. It is clotted with mud. They wouldn't have let me in. I mean, seriously, it's dog-friendly, but I'm not sure it's cyclist-friendly. I'm not sure they'll let me in at all. But the upshot of this is, it's been, you know, needless to say, it started raining as soon as I got on the bike, but not heavily, and it's still calm. The cloud ceiling is higher than it has been for quite some time, although, as you can hear from the helicopter in the distance there, you know, the sound bounces up, hits the cloud, comes back down again. There is cloud just about everywhere, but I just feel so much better. So it's all very well and good saying, come on, just get up, out you go, you'll feel better. 4 days ago, I probably wouldn't have. Today, different ballgame.
The state bird of Aberdeenshire, the helicopter.
Yeah, it does like to follow us around, actually.
It does.
The minute
does.
You hit record, yeah, out it appears.
Out it pops, and it just circles a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, do you think that you might have always had a bit of sad in the winter months?
Yes. Yeah. Because I notice a huge difference in energy levels between winter and summer, and I sometimes lay myself, you know, lay projects aside thinking, come the winter, I'll actually do that. And I really, genuinely struggle to do anything in the evenings.
Yeah.
Genuinely struggle to do anything in the evenings. I mean, if it's something, you know, that's kind of grabbed me by the throat, then you can get on with it. But it's got to be something pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. You know, just doing something recreationally.
But it's funny that it's only just clicked in your mind now that it could be seasonal affective disorder.
Well, no, I've always thought that daylight has something to do with it, but what this was slightly different in that I think it was something to do with the weather. The weather was just... It took what little energy was left in the heart of me, mate, and just squelched it, you know. But I felt so much different last Sunday. It was, I mean, and as soon as I woke up, I thought, oh, this is different.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's only going to get better now because we're careering towards spring.
Alison Downey is also careering. She says, I had no idea that Radio Scotland was still broadcasting 5 live until 6:30. As I have a 30-mile training run this morning, getting the train to Linlithgow and running home to Dunblane, I'm dragging my long-suffering husband with me. Safe to say, he's less than enthusiastic.
Oh, Alison, good on you.
Yeah, anyway, coming up, we've got a giant catch on the River Deveron, and it was a giant catch, and some hairy ubits.
Oh, I like that word. It's a good one, isn't it?
Aye.
Yes.
What's wrong with you? Here are you,
bits. We've also got a mystery sound for you. Let's have a listen.
Barbie from Troon says, good grief, Do you want to send the puppy into more than the usual bounce? That noise, is it a squeaky door to a pigsty? And apparently he's off to guide round Dundonald Castle soon. All welcome.
Mm. Lachy says an easy one this week. It's obviously an orca going through a squeaky door into his local village hall. You're smugly. Alan Mark says, good morning. I'm guessing the mystery sound is a distressed donkey. A bit damp here in West Lothian. And Alistair and Elgin, is the sound a rusty tin roof shed?
With I was a wondering how he's going to work it this week.
With a door that needs oil. Still too dark in Elgin to gauge the weather, but fingers crossed it stays dry. I've an old wooden felt roof shed which is falling down and I hope to finish the job.
Yes.
Best of luck with that.
Yeah, precisely. No, well, this, if there's light.
There's light.
Light in the sky with us.
Yeah,
you know?
And that's a really nice feeling, actually. Lots of time for you to get in touch with your guesses. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is our email address. You can text us 80295 or phone Alex on 0808 592 9500.
If you are familiar with the Balgavie's Loch Nature Reserve in Angus, chances are you'll have bumped into Warden Jim Hughes.
Yeah, Jim's celebrated 25 years in post at the Scottish Wildlife Trust site near Forfar, and he's a big character. He's as big a character as the osprey switch nest there. When we met up recently at Balgavie's, I asked him to tell me about the most memorable moment of his career, the day he had to rescue an osprey chick after its nest and the tree it was resting on collapsed into the loch.
I got a call about 7 in the morning from two regular dog walkers that come round here, Jim and Mary Rogers, and they said, Jim, the nest tree appears to be missing. And I said, you mean drinking? The tree's missing. They says, Jim, the tree's down and it's in the water. I couldn't believe it, you know. I says, right, I'll be there shortly. And up to long, here, the tree had collapsed and then the nest was in the loch and the tree. No sign of the young bird. The adults were screaming their heads off on the island. We couldn't believe what we were seeing. So I suggest that they go for a walk one way and I'll go the other way and search to see if we could find the youngster.
And how old was the youngster?
The youngster was about 2 or 3 days off of fledging, which would be about 34 days, 35 days. It was ready to fledge any time, but we thought it maybe lost it. You know, it could have been drowned, predated, whatever. But about half an hour later, I got a phone call again saying, Jim, it's on the main path near the main road. And I says, I'll be there in 5 minutes. So I went up, I took a long landing net with me, saw the bird on the path. I managed to catch it in my landing net. Couldn't believe my eyes, the size of it, because no one, you never get close to ospreys. Wrapped up in a big towel I had and put it in my truck. Took it down to my house and then I put it in a big cage that I had there to calm it down. Gave it fresh water. Couldn't believe it. It drunk from up straight away. It must have been thirsty. And it was a scorching hot day that day. So I covered it up with a wet towel, got in touch with the authorities. And Rob Potter, the reserves manager, got in touch with two guys in Edinburgh who are experts as far as this kind of thing and rescuing raptors go. In the meantime, Jim and Mary nipped into Forfar and, believe it or not, bought two sea bass. I says, I can't see it taking these. We fed it and it ate the hood of two of them, devoured them. No problem at all. So I knew it was calm and it was going to be quite okay. It was now stressed. I ate the fish and I had to drink fresh water. And as the day passed, it was still there at 7 or 8 o'clock at night when, because the guys come through for Fife. We carried it up in the cage to the peninsula and they decided it wasn't suitable to put it back on the island. So I gave them a big wire basket out at the house and we made a temporary nest. Robin climbed the tree, fastened the nest with cable ties and various fastenings, and put some branches in it, etc. Pulled the youngster up in a bag, settled it in the nest. By this time it was just getting dark, but the parents were still over on the island, and we could only cross my fingers, hope for the best. It got dark. Next morning at 7 o'clock I went up, couldn't believe my eyes. The parents were over there and they were feeding the youngster, and everything was good. Within days, they started rebuilding the nest on the temporary nest, which we couldn't believe were eyes.
So this is on the metal cage?
On the metal cage. 2 days later, the youngster fledged, fully fledged, it was flying. That was a great thing. So we knew everything was going to be well, but the shock was building a new nest. So they built a new nest on there, and we couldn't believe our luck. So the youngster fledged. The female left for Senegal when it was time for it to leave, middle of September, and the male still was there with the youngster. And eventually, both of them left. And we just said, we don't know what's going to happen next year. Will they go back to that nest? Will they try and rebuild elsewhere? Will they abandon Bulgais? They came back and immediately rebuilt a nest there again and repaired it and built a huge nest. And three youngsters in 2023. And the bonus was we were able to ring them because with the one that was lost from the nest, no intention of ringing it. But the thing was, why not ring it while we've got it here? Mm. So they rung it and it's Blue 640. We've had word back from Senegal from a contact there that it's been spotted twice on a reserve and it's very healthy and doing well. Maybe we'll see it next year with a bit of luck. It's usually 2 to 3 years before they come back.
That must be a good feeling.
Everybody's overjoyed with it. Like, you know, people couldn't believe how well it worked out because it could have been a real catastrophe. It was sitting on the main road, off the main road on a track. It could only go two ways, onto the main road or on a deep undergrowth. And if that had happened, we would have lost it.
What on earth had happened to the original tree then that your nest was on?
We think the tree came down because of stress. Because that was one of these days in the summer of 22 when we had terrific heat. It was really, really hot. And it wasn't a wind, there was no storm. And it was no three winds around during the night. And that's why I couldn't believe that when they phoned me, the tree was down. And the tree was healthy because you could see where the break was. It was clean, healthy timber. It wasn't rotten or nothing. It was just one of these freak calls of nature, like, you know.
And they've built their new nest pretty close to where the old one was.
Well, the new nest's only 40 metres away from the island where the old nest was. Mm. We're hoping to see them back very shortly, in the end of March this year.
Now, you've been here for 25 years. You can't surely have any stories that top that.
There's quite a few, but some I can't tell you about. That's just like a paradise, you know, when I first came here. That's what I said, this place looks like paradise. And it was very quiet at that time because the ospreys were nesting here. They tried to nest in 2010, 2011, but no one else could believe it. Geese took the nest first. Two grey lag geese, and we'd never seen that before. So these grey lags commandeered the nest. The ospreys tried to fight them off, but the geese won. They had it in 2010, 2011. 2012, the ospreys got the nest, and the first one was bred here, Blue ID. And since then, the ospreys have had the nest ever since.
Jim Hughes there, warden at Bulgais Loch Nature Reserve near Forfar.
Yeah, nice story, isn't it? Nice story. And of course, he's looking forward to seeing if that wee osprey returns. Not very wee at all.
Not terribly wee in the slightest, no.
No.
The one they caught in the landing net.
He said it was fascinating being that close to an osprey, because obviously you're never normally very close to them at all, and you shouldn't be very close to them. But he said to actually pick it up and feel it in your arms is a funny sensation, yeah.
I can't remember where it was, but Falconry Centre, and I had a golden eagle in my arm. Given the size of it, I mean, it's about the size of a Labrador, but remarkably light in comparison. You know, just it's, you know, you looked, the image was such that you thought, I'm not going to be able to hold this up.
Yeah.
But actually, you could.
Yeah. Yeah. And was it odd looking into its eyes?
I wasn't trying to get that close to its face, to be honest.
Scared, were you?
just cautious, that's all.
We've news now of a new podcast we think you might like. Now Where is a six-part series where presenter May Robson crosses the UK to hear from people coming together to fight neighbourhood decline and neglect.
In the first episode, May travels to the Isle of Ulva. Now, Ulva was once home to about 600 folk. By 2015, just five were left. And as you may remember, the community were able to buy the island and run it themselves. 6 years on, May finds out how the community is faring.
It's a short ride in a deflating dinghy. The island stretches out before us, deep green and brown under a moody summer sky. Ulva's name is Norse. It's thought to mean Island of the Wolves. It's about 12 kilometres long and 4 kilometres wide, with jagged cliffs that plunge dramatically into the surrounding sea. It has no shops, no roads, and luckily no wolves. But it is home to red deer, sea eagles, seals, otters, and a very rare kind of moth. You'd be forgiven for thinking that people had never lived here, that Ulva had always been this wild place. But back in the 1800s, this small island was home to a thriving community of about 600 people. Scottish islands have become collector's items for the rich and famous, and Olva has been considered the perfect possession. The island has been privately owned for centuries, and it's suffered more than most. Over the years, the population has declined and declined and declined.
When I lived here, we had to sieve the bath for tadpoles. The most, I think we had about 26 in one sieve, from one bathful. And they were all alive, so you could go and let them out. I'm Mike Lang. I am the operations manager for the island of Olva.
A giant of a man with warm, sparkling blue eyes, Mike was the first person I met. Mike's no stranger to island life. It can be cold, wet, windy, and often frustrating. But life on Olva in the 80s sounded particularly grim.
On a really windy day, your curtains would be coming in at 45-degree angles inside. You know, all rotten windows. You know, it could be very damp, very cold.
And how many people were living on Olva when you were living there?
When I was here, there was about 22 people lived on the island. And there was 900 people here at one point.
By 2015, just two households were left, three adults and two children. And it's here that the story gets interesting, because Olva, run down and almost deserted, was on the brink of a new era. In 2017, Jamie Howard, a retired army general whose family had owned Olva for the last 70 years, put it up for sale. And the remaining residents decided to buy back their island and run it themselves.
To start getting a heart back in the community, it's begging out for it. You see, we've got all this land here. You know, if we could put in nice housing, which we're looking at doing, I mean, the houses that go in will be beautiful houses and built for the job, you know, family houses, and hopefully we can rebuild a community. It's a very special island. And just to get some more people and to build up that heart again would be an absolutely fabulous thing to do.
So how did they do it? Well, in Scotland, communities have the chance to buy their land if it comes up for sale. It's what they call a community buyout. In city dweller terms, it's like if your housing estate went up for sale and you had a right to buy it and run it with your neighbours. What's unique in Scotland is the scale on which this can happen. Communities can own buildings, but also forests, rural estates, and even islands like this one. They're also given a lot of government support to do this. The community has first right of refusal, time to raise the money, and can access funding to help.
The Scottish Government has carefully considered the application, and I'm delighted to announce that we have today granted permission to the people of Olva to bring their island into community ownership.
It's 6 years on from the buyout, and residents are working hard at the huge task of actually running an island. And small though it might be, the population has already doubled. Phil Burton is one of the new residents. He runs the farm here. He moved from Harris in the Outer Hebrides with his wife Shona 4 years ago.
It's a very peaceful thing, listening to cows eat.
Yeah.
Sound of contentment.
Around us, Highland cattle are chomping away. They're ginger-haired with curved horns and huge brown eyes that peer out from behind long fringes. They're grazing on land that hadn't been farmed in over 15 years.
Okay, I've had Highlanders now for 4 years. Started off with two, and we now have quite a lot.
So this allowed you basically to have the chance to develop your own farm?
Coming down to Olva to take on the farms, it has allowed me to do what I love doing, but do it full time and not have to have a second job as well.
Was there much competition for you to apply for the farm?
To be honest, when I applied, I didn't hold out much hope. I was quite surprised to get an interview, even more surprised to be offered the chance to come. So any farm opportunity in Scotland is generally quite highly sought after. Certainly there would be absolutely no chance of a new entrant or a young person being able to buy their own farm unless they were independently wealthy or had some sort of family help or something like that. Tenancies are the only way really for young people or new entrants to get going with farming.
It's been a massive opportunity for Phil to get into farming. Elsewhere, the high cost and lack of land makes it really difficult for new entrants. Phil lives in the Fisherman's Cottage, one of six newly refurbished houses across the island. It's a large, whitewashed building that looks right out over the water. Where affordable housing is at a shortage across the Scottish Isles, here rents are cheap and tenancies are secure. But as Andy explains, Olva was always about more than just housing.
This concept of community, you know, it gets thrown around a lot, but actually what does it mean? And what are you creating when you're talking about community? Is community just a collection of houses? I don't think it is. I don't think a community is a housing estate. But a community is something else. Community is sitting in the mind of people. It's not something that's a physical creation. It helps a lot if you've got houses.
There are other, more intangible benefits.
What's the most significant thing for you about being community-owned?
It's the fact that it can't be taken away. Well, it's owned by the community, then it's owned by the community. There's very strict rules we have to follow through our housing. So we can't just say, oh, actually, I don't like you, out you go. You know, people are protected. We would like people to be part of the community and to work as part of the community. But once they're here, it's up to them. It's up to them. And it's not being ruled by some rich guy somewhere who might visit once a year.
If you want to listen to more of the story of Olva, or indeed in any of the other episodes that May Robson put together, the series called Now Here, and it's available on the BBC Sounds app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, I've not actually visited that island, but you've been, haven't you?
Several times, mm-hmm. Several times. I did smile when she says, you know, it's a white cottage which overlooks the sea. It's an island. It all overlooks the sea. There might be a property that doesn't overlook the sea, but I can't think of it off the top of my head.
Yeah, move to go far and wide to find it.
But it's an interesting point that they're making there about the fact that, you know, once people are in, they're protected, once they're part of the community, but it's getting in the first place. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you know, the selection process always makes me feel slightly uneasy too. I mean, you think about it in terms of, you know, the estate where you live. Mm-hmm. You know, if not just you were trying to buy the house, but you then had to run the gauntlet of a selection process of people who already lived there, yeah. It would be odd, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be. It would become almost a popularity contest. You know, how do you market yourself?
You'd be living in a cardboard box somewhere.
I would be.
Anyway, let's go back to the River Devon. As you might expect, they were opening the salmon fishing season there last Monday. As you might expect, there's always a good tale to be told of exceptional catches from way back when, but also I came across an absolute cracker of a much more recent catch. Here's Richie Miller from the Devon District Salmon Fishery Board again.
So this is a very special year on Devon side. This is the centenary of the largest UK fly-caught fish, which was caught here on the Devon in 1924 by Mrs. Clementina Tiny Morrison. The fish weighed 61 pounds, which is really quite a huge, huge Atlantic salmon, and was caught on a fly called the Brown Wing Killer.
I take it she was called Tiny, not just because it was Clementina. She wasn't a big woman.
No, that's right. They wasn't very, very tall, but fantastic angler. And on the day that they caught the big fish, she also caught four other fish over 12 pounds, so she really was an accomplished angler.
That's an extraordinary achievement. It was 61 pounds. How did she get it into the bank?
So when Tiny hooked the fish, it was obviously a very strong fish, being 61 pounds, and it swam up and down the river a few times as she played it. And thankfully, as it came in close to the side, her gilly managed to get a hold of it and land it. But it'd been quite a struggle, obviously, because, you know, there's 2.2 pound in a kilo, so that's a serious fish.
It's a very, very serious fish. Now, it's a lot of meat as well, a lot of salmon. What did they do with it?
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. So they
days before catch and release.
Yes, of course. Yeah, the Atlantic salmon numbers was abundant then. So the fish went to Aberdeen for a plaster cast to be made of it, so that you know, it could be shown to people for years to come. And then the fish itself was smoked and was actually handed it out to the estate workers at Mount Blairy.
£61, and I've read an account saying that it was probably underweighed.
Yes, that's right. It can be a bit controversial, that.
How could it be underweighed, though? I mean, do fish lose weight after they've been caught?
Yeah, so the fish was, I think it was weighed 48 hours after the fish was caught due to the post office being shut, which it only had the big enough scales to weigh it. So people do believe that it maybe lost a couple of pound. Yeah. And if it has genuinely lost, then it would be obviously up there with the biggest Atlantic salmon to be caught in the UK ever, which was caught by Mrs. Ballantyne on the Tay.
Do you ever think the day will come when another 60-pound salmon is caught in the Devon?
I would love to think so, but to be honest, I think it'll be unlikely. We have a new sonar fish counter on the Devon here, and we did see some sizeable fish come in last year, but not to that level.
When you say sizeable, how big?
Upwards of 30 pounds.
Okay.
So half, obviously. But I would love to see a fish like that come back, and you never know, there might be one someday.
My name is Andrew McGarvey. I'm a visiting angler from South Wales, and we come up to fish the Devon in late September. Middle to late September, and in that week, I caught five beautiful salmon, one of which was 28 to 32 pounder, which won the Devon trophy.
Can I ask, I asked this because it was mentioned actually at the opening ceremony, you don't have much in the way of sight.
I have very little. I'm blind in the left eye and I have about 5% vision in my right eye.
So how do you fish?
By feel and knowing roughly where I'm standing.
Tell me about catching the biggest fish. What's the story behind it? Because there's a story behind it.
It was mid-morning, third or fourth cast, I hooked this fish, and it just took off. And it took me about 40 minutes to pull it in, during which time I was screaming for help, because my son was supposedly on the next pool down. But wind conditions weren't brilliant, and he didn't hear me for a very long time. But the farmer opposite did. And he looked through his binoculars and could see me, that I hadn't moved in over half an hour, and decided that either I was stuck on the bottom or it's into a big fish. And he chose the latter, thankfully, and phoned the ghillie for help. And he came down to the river to ask me what the matter was. And I said to him that I had a big fish, and would he mind driving to the end of the field and talking to my son and telling him to come up?
In the nicest possible way, indeed.
And about 5 minutes later, this figure wandered up the bank, and I greet him with the, where the blank blank has he been? And I thought it was my son, because I couldn't see. But it wasn't my son, it was Mr. Carl Malpas, the ghillie. And that was my apology to him.
Yeah.
He did an expert job in netting it for me, because I really couldn't see it. And he was right on the edge of the bank, and it was high water too, so he did a very good job.
I'm just trying to still get a sense of this. How close was the fish to you before you could actually see it?
Oh, about... Well, it was in the net.
Yeah.
That's
so
when
about
I
six
could
feet
see
away,
it.
Basically.
Yes, about that, yeah. I had no idea how big it was. I couldn't even see it coming in the water, because the sun was... Well, glare on the water for me is pretty bad.
Yeah.
So I couldn't really see it until it was right at the very end when Carl scooped it out.
Two things you must have been: elated and absolutely knackered.
I was. My voice was hoarse from shouting, because I had no idea how I was going to land this fish. And, it was on for a very long time, 45, 50 minutes, by the time it was landed. But in the end, I could feel it coming towards the bank, and I knew it was close then. But that was it.
Andrew McGarvey there, winner of last year's Morrison Trophy for his catch of a 28-pound salmon. Before that, we heard from Richie Miller from the Devon District Salmon Fishery Board talking about Tiny Morrison, you know, obviously the person that trophy is actually named after. What I find astonishing about Andrew's story is at no stage did he think, I'm letting this go.
No, exactly.
It's not worth the hassle.
Yeah,
you know?
Can't be bothered with this.
Can't
just
be bothered
leave
with
it.
This.
Yeah. I was just thinking of Tiny and our 60-pound fish. Imagine that coming into your fridge.
Aye.
Yeah, no, what's that, for tea tonight? Yeah, salmon for the foreseeable future.
For quite some time to come. No, well, I said they smoked it and they basically distributed it around the community.
Yeah.
Because it would have gone to waste otherwise.
Well, yeah, it would have done. And I think they took a horse and cart to come, didn't they, to take it away from the river bank.
They had to wait for the post office to open before they could wait. You know, that kind of stuff changed days.
Yeah, lovely stuff. Oh, and nice photographs, actually, of Tiny as well. She obviously was a petite woman.
Yeah, a bit on the petite side. But I thoroughly enjoyed that opening ceremony in the Devon. It was really interesting people there. People that really cared about the river, cared about, you know, sort of nature and wildlife and everything else, and, you know, wanted to see it all working together.
Yeah, and do it even though they know fine well they may never see a salmon, or very few salmon.
Yeah. Indeed.
Now, there's a welcome return to our screens tomorrow for The Adventure Show. A brand new series kicks off with two new presenters, and joining us to tell us a bit more about it is one of those presenters, BBC Alibi star Callum McLean.
Callum, nice to have you on the programme.
Good morning, thanks for having me on.
No problem at all. I think the last time we met up was in Aberfeldy in the river. how did you feel when they asked you to host The Adventure Show?
I was delighted. It's a programme I've watched for quite a few years, and in covering the, you know, some of the, this series is all about event coverage, and some of the races that we'll be covering, you know, I've competed in before, I've taken part in. And, of course, the co-presenter is Mary Meldrum, who I know from racing against. I say racing against, she's always way ahead of me in any events that I've done, pretty much. It was fantastic to get the opportunity to showcase. You know, we've got these world-class events in Scotland, and to showcase them again, to the country is brilliant. So, yeah, I was delighted to sign up and say, yeah.
Tell us a bit more about Mary, then.
Yeah, so she is a teacher, as well as being an incredible athlete and obviously presenting as well. So we've known each other for, I don't know, about 5 or 6 years or so. Mary does lots and lots of outdoors events in Scotland, mountain biking, running, swimming. So we met at a swim-run race, I think it was, either that or a triathlon years ago. And a swim-run is basically you run, then you swim, then you run, a long continuous route carrying everything with you. So that one was out in the Hebrides, quite a wild race. And so she, for this series of The Adventure Show, at least for the first episode, she took part in the whole event, which was the Strathpuffer 24-hour mountain bike race. So I had the easy shift. I was kind of the main presenter, but she was doing the whole 24-hour race and presenting as well. So, I shouldn't be complaining about anything, but she did the whole thing. And the amazing thing about Mary is she does everything with a big smile on her face, which you'll see through the programme. And she's like that all the time in real life. So, yeah, it'd be hard, even a 24-hour mountain bike race, you know, cycling through the dark and the cold in a forest, doesn't take the smile off her face, so she's quite amazing in that way.
We actually have a clip from tomorrow's episode where, frankly, it's manifestly obvious, Callum, you were skiving completely, and Mary was taking part in the Strathpuffer. More about that in a second, but let's just have a wee listen to the clip.
So, Mary, you've just done your fifth lap now. I'm going to jump on the bike and give you a wee bit of support. You're looking a bit muddy.
Yeah, I am. Well, I saw her walking up there.
As it goes, I've got a towel in my bag. Let's do it.
Okay, let's go.
A few laps in, do you feel the pace is dropping? Are you feeling strong still?
I think I'm about averaging the same. I think by lap six, I'll feel good because it's a quarter of the way, kind of through perhaps.
Yay!
But I definitely need to wake up, so I think that welcome swim will be fantastic.
Oh, what a treat, Mary. Look at this. Still keen?
Absolutely.
This was your idea.
Yeah, but you're the villain victim.
There you go, Mary. Just a wee bit of ice.
Whoa.
I think we just a full immersion and that counts.
One, two, three.
Right, I'm going to let you go. You're going to probably have to get warmed up.
Looking forward to it.
All the best. See you, Mary.
Bye.
Go, 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 go. That's Mary off for another lap now and hopefully feeling refreshed after the quick duke in the water. I know I am anyway. And hopefully she's not too cold for the next couple of laps. The Puffer is not all about racing, you know. Everyone needs to take a break at some point, and this is the place to come. The Marquee. You can buy some merch, you can charge your lights, you can get some hot food, you can get a coffee. And I've managed to blag the last cup of coffee just before they're shutting for the night. But they're going to be open again at 3 in the morning. Slantcha.
What is the Strathpuffer?
So the Strathpuffer is... it's a mountain bike race, 24 hours, doing a loop of about 12 kilometres in a forest near Conton, that Tor Achilty Forest, that's northwest of Inverness. And you start at 10 in the morning, you cycle continuous lap through to 10 in the morning from Saturday to Sunday. And you can either do it solo or you can do it as a pair, in which you swap every lap, or you can do it as a quad. That's four people, and you can swap kind of every two laps, every lap, whatever you like. You get to choose it yourself. And the amazing thing about it is it's a race, but it's also almost like an event, almost like a music festival, because every single competitor, they can do it, you know, completely solo, but most of them have a support crew. So whether they take a motorhome, a camper van, some people take tents, you know, to go for a snooze during the night. And they've usually got three or four people helping them, just to feed them, just to, you know, fix their bike, to swap their bike if it breaks. And they're dotted right throughout the forest. So as they cycle up the way towards the kind of single track, slightly more technical stuff, they're passing by, you know, probably at least a mile of just camper vans and cars parked up all over the place. Some people sitting out, some people bivvying out in the forest throughout the night. Some people do it in like semi-luxury, but some other people really rough it. And there was one guy just came completely solo, slept beside his Land Rover out in the forest, didn't have any support at all, whereas some people had like, I don't know, three or four people just to look after the bike sometimes. So it was quite incredible, the different standards and the different way people do it. The people who are at the front of the race, obviously the ability, the standard is really, really high, and they keep going continuously, only stopping to eat, really. And then we get people who are taking it on as a personal challenge, and, you know, if they can do a few laps, that's really what they want to get out of it. So it was quite amazing to see the difference in, you know, aims, but also just the atmosphere of it is quite incredible. And people's reasons for doing it as well. So you'll see all that throughout the programme. It's a race, but it's more than just, you know, about who wins.
You can see why you might need a coffee by 3 o'clock in the morning. You've obviously met some interesting people. As you say, they've got very different reasons for doing this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. You see the people at the front, you know, very focused on winning the race, but still some of them quite relaxed at the same time. And then there's a whole variety, I mean, there's a whole variety of ages as well and abilities, really. So some people who have barely mountain biked before and then, you know, hear about this challenge, hear about this race, sign up for it, especially because it's during winter. It's really something to aim and focus for when, the days are so short and the nights are so long, because you're going to be cycling through the night. So it's a good way to get to train towards that, especially in Scotland. You know, winter just is long nights quite often. It's, for some people, it's just almost proving a point, potentially, that they can do it. And for other people, you know, there was a group of youngsters there, teenagers, getting around the course. There's one teenager doing it solo who was really quite young, trying to beat his dad's number of laps from last year. So, yeah, an amazing range of abilities. And I think that's a great thing, because and there's always going to be people who are competitive, and it's great to see people really pushing the boundaries and seeing how fast the quads teams go, for example. It's quite incredible. But it's also a great thing for anyone that watches the programme and, you know, might not be a dedicated cyclist to think, wow, that's something I could actually try and take on, you know, challenge myself, you know, set a goal for next year, for next 2 years' time, and, you know, really challenge yourself. Because by doing that, it exposes you, your mind, to all sorts of new experiences and helps improve you as a person, I think, personally.
When you do something like that, I mean, as in when you do something like this, Callum, where are you mentally? I mean, are you one of the sort of hyper-competitive types, or are you just enjoying being there?
It's changed over the years. I mean, I have to admit, I've never done the whole Strathpuffer race, but I've done all other events and, you know, things over 24 hours. It's changed over the years. I've probably become less competitive with other people in a way, and more interested in personal challenges, I think, over the last few years. For me, you know, if I'm doing a loop, sometimes I want to stop and have a look at something, or like Mari suggested, stop and go for a duke. That's the kind of thing I enjoy doing. Whereas, you know, if you're just focused on getting another lap, that's kind of changed for me, I think, in the past maybe 5-6 years or so. I used to be certainly more competitive against other people in that way, but it's changed. It might come back, you never know, and maybe me and Mari will have a race sometime, but I think I know who would win that, and it might not be me.
I think we all know, Callum. Listen, thank you very much for joining us this morning. That was kind of you.
No problem at all. You can see, I should give it a quick plug. Tomorrow night, 7:45 at the BBC Scotland channel, and on the iPlayer afterwards, The Adventure Show.
Good man, good man. Thank you very much. Callum McLean there. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stevens. Sitting right next to me here at Beech Grove is Rachel Stewart. Neither of us are going to go for a duke anytime soon. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, you can catch up whenever you like by looking the programme up on BBC Sound. You can download the app. That's what I would do.
Yeah, precisely. Or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, all available from BBC Sounds. We like hearing from you. Get in touch, which is what Kevin Clements in Arkansas did. He says, hello, Out of Doors team. In the past year, I've started to listen to your programme, especially on Saturday while making breakfast. Like some of the other BBC Sound shows, your content is very engaging to both heart and head. Each week, I look forward to the mystery sound with eager anticipation.
The fact that you talk to your fellow Scots about their areas of interest in the locations they live out their lives has helped to connect me to my family's Scottish heritage. Also, my thanks for reminding me on the broadcast today to contact you. Thanks, says Kevin. It's time for our mystery sound again. Let's have a listen. This is especially for you, Kevin.
Yeah, well, it's not mechanical.
I wondered how long it would take you to say that.
I've been remarkably restrained. Gwen Blair thinks it might be a fender on Ewan's boat rubbing against the harboured wall. She's quite light up at Inverness now, yet.
Mm-hmm. Doogie and Anya in Cooper. Morning, peeps. Is the sound a crane trumpeting? Anya was cycling too yesterday. Wild swimming next today, methinks. Great fishy show, thank you.
Jackie Stewart thinks it might be the sound of a squeaking gate when we unlock it to get access to our kit for Pleen Park Run.
Sandy.
See what he did there?
I like it, yeah. Sandy Faden Lucas says that he thinks the noise might be a mule. Keep up the good work.
Layla thinks, glad to hear you have light this morning. The mystery sound is my downstairs neighbour's living room door in the middle of the night. Wakes me up in a cold sweat. I keep meaning to pop down with some WD-40 and whack him with it.
Yeah. Heather from Linlithgow, is the mystery sound a dolphin?
Sandy Johnson thought it might be a seal or a walrus. This is it. MV Isle of Arran rubbing on the new fenders at Arberth and Ardrossan Harbour. Says Big Bad John in Darkport, Glasgow.
Mm-hmm. Stuart and Elgin also thinks it might be a grey seal. Ian and Tully Nestle gets it a wee bit too right for us to read it out, so we're not. Janet from Perth said, is it a rusty rollock on a rowing boat? If not, that'll do
it. A
rusty rollock on a rowing boat.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Okay. If not, that'll do as a handy tongue twister to check for sobriety. I think I maybe just about failed that, Janet. Still got time to get in touch. Have you got another guess?
No, just Big Bad John in Darkport, Glasgow. I can never see the words Port Glasgow without remembering that years ago there used to be a wildlife park just outside Loch Lomond, and for whatever reason, the beavers were constantly escaping from it. Constantly escaping. And one of them made their way right the way down the river, across the Clyde, and ended up a back alley in Port Glasgow.
Ah.
How terrified must that beaver have been?
Must have been. Get in touch. You've still got time to have a guess, but get them in quite quick now. We're running out of time. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295 or you can give us a ring on 0808 529500.
A few weeks ago, I met up with a really interesting fella called Bill Ritchie. Bill's a retired embryologist. He was actually involved in the cloning of Dolly the sheep way back when. But nowadays, he's engaged in an entirely different pursuit. And this got my attention, because Bill is building his own plane.
This is SpaceX. SD1 Mini Sport, and it's something I'm in the middle of building at the moment.
Just off to the side of it is a Citroën de Chavaux in bits. And it's bigger than your plane.
Well, yes. I did read someone who was reviewing the actual aircraft, and he said, you more or less strap it on. But
it's, it's a flying jacket.
All right. And the aircraft with wings, with everything in place, weighs 120 kilos.
Wow.
It has got...
What's that about? 17 and a half stone, old money, something like that.
Something like that, yeah. You can get various different engines, but this one is a Briggs & Stratton.
Uh-huh. Well, the lawnmower people.
Yes, it is out of the lawnmower, this engine. It's been modified, but I mean, people fly Volkswagen engined planes as well, so it's not unusual, but it's a 33 horsepower and do somewhere about 90 knots, about 100 miles an hour.
100 miles an hour.
Five litres of fuel an hour.
And from the sort of tip of the tail to the tip of the nose, how long is it?
About 15 feet.
Gee whiz. And the wingspan?
About 20. A wing weighs sort of 12 and a half kilograms.
There doesn't seem to be an awful lot of room in the cockpit.
It's only a single seat, so it's a case of having one person in there, quite cosy, and 100 miles an hour. But it's mostly wood. Some of the ply is 3-ply, and it is 0.8 of a millimetre thick. Mm-hmm. If you put a torch on the other side, you can see where the torch is. But it's virtually, not much thicker than a piece of thick paper.
But do you buy this as as a bag of bits?
You can buy it. You can buy it as a bag of bits. You can buy it as partially constructed. You can buy it as almost completely constructed.
So presumably this is a cheap way of owning an aircraft and flying.
It's
cheapish.
It's cheap. I mean, equivalent to buying a second-hand car, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And
so, how much would this cost you?
It starts from about 10,000-12,000 up to, you can buy one ready to fly for about 25,000.
Yeah, it's tempting. It's very tempting.
You have to have pilot's license to fly it, but inspection of the actual aircraft itself is minimal, really. So, as long as it fulfills all the other regulations, then you can fly it. You don't need all sorts of people inspecting it annually as you do for microlights.
I'm just trying to see what you've got in the way of instrumentation. Not an awful lot.
Well, it's got what they call a glass cockpit. It's got a little module in here which picks up the engine revs, the cylinder head temperature, oil pressure, all sorts of things, and displays them on the screen there. Okay. It will also give you flying instruments as well. So it will tell you how fast you're going up and or down, whether the wings are level, what speed you're going at, all these sort of things that you would require for flying this.
And what's your range on this?
Well, it's got about a 35 litre tank, and as I say,
for
it
seven
will
hours.
It will do, yes, more than a bladder's worth.
Yes, and we're not talking about a fuel bladder there. We're talking about your bladder.
No. We're talking about my bladder. Yes.
Precisely.
Yes, but.
Yeah. Has it got any storage in it at all? I was just trying to think, if you wanted to take a packet of sandwiches, where would you put it?
No. It has got 10 kilograms of storage.
Uh-huh. I've got a wee hatch at the top. Okay. You've just ducked underneath the tail. I'm not going to do that in case I take the tail off accidentally. All right, okay.
So there's a container, that one there. Goes into there, so you've got 10 kilograms of stowage. Mm. And Mike, who has one across there, he puts his tent in there and his sleeping bag. There's storage under here as well, so he can go camping.
Theoretically, you've got over, if you've got ideal flying conditions, you've got over 600 miles range. Mm-hmm. Altitude?
If you go over more than 10,000 feet, you need oxygen.
Yeah.
Normally, you wouldn't be flying at that sort of height.
Cannot begin to tell you how envious I am.
Must be your next project, is it?
Seriously, that was Bill Ritchie, but seriously, I have bigger jackets. It's a brilliant wee thing. It's an absolutely brilliant wee thing.
Your wife must dread some of these projects that you get set on, thinking, that's going to give him ideas.
No. Well, seriously, it is. There was a Citroen 2CV parked beside it and what have you. The plane, I think, was actually marginally longer, but really not by much, and it's got a 20-foot wingspan. You know, and the ply that it's built out of, the actual body and things like that, you can push it. It malforms, just, you know, and it's going to hang in the air. It's going to work. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, during the Second World War, mosquitoes were built out of, you know, wooden balsa wood, more or less. Big rubber band down the middle. But this, you know, it's a really cracking piece of construction.
Has he got much still to do?
I don't know. I wouldn't be competent to actually answer that question. It looks like he's quite well on.
Yeah. And if you were getting a plane like that, would you buy a ready-made one at 25 grand, or would you like the challenge of piecing it all together?
I don't think I would go for a plane like that.
No.
I don't think I would go for a plane. I think probably for 25,000 you could get something slightly bigger. Mm-hmm. You know, because it is just, it is terribly, terribly, terribly snug.
Yeah, you'd want to take a passenger up, wouldn't you? Show off.
if you could, you know. But I remember last going to Perth Airport and what have you, and they said, oh, you know, would you like to fly in this? And it was a wee Australian microlight called a Grasshopper. And it's basically an aluminium frame, you know, both the fuselage and the wings and things, with a ripstop nylon sock that pulls over the whole, pulls over the fuselage, and then two socks that pull over the wings. And it's held on with zips.
Oof.
No, I'm not flying in anything. It's held together with zips. No.
No chance.
No, not a chance. Anyway.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, I spent a brilliant afternoon with a lady called Susie Briggs. She's made her name already as a poet, storyteller and performer, and she can now add Galloway Scots Screever to her list of titles. Over the next year, she'll be creating lots of original writing in her native tongue. Now, as you'll hear, Susie is passionate about nature and the outdoors in Dumfries and Galloway, and she told me a bit about her life as we walked round some of the places locally which have inspired her.
Well, I grew up in Dumfries in the Toon in a council estate. In two different council estates, Lochside and Lincluden. And it was a wee bit rough, and there was always building sites to play on and that. But when the frost came, it seemed to change the landscape of the place. It became enchanting and magical. And I mind going for walks with my father at night time when it was so sparkling like that. And it inspired me to write Nip Naps, which was published in 2017. And Nip Naps was illustrated by Ruthie Redden. The pictures are absolutely gorgeous. And it's a story about Jack Frost and how he makes the landscape beautiful and pristine. So to see my wee toon just turn absolutely pristine is just otherworldly. It was like stepping into the world of the fae, almost. And I mind my father and my mother telling me to put my socks on, or knit-nebs will come and prinkle your tays and things like that. And inside the council house, there would be like forests and ferns on the windies, like painted, but it would be on the inside of the windies. It was before double glazing. And although we were freezing, I did feel there was just some sort of magic with it.
And of course you write in Scots and Galloway Scots as well, and you obviously love the words that are local to this area.
I do love the words. When I first started writing in Scots, I didn't have any Scots literacy at all. All I was ever taught to read and write in was English. So when I started translating some of my English written stories into Scots, there was a line in the story Last Berry which said, it was a cold frosty morning in Jeannie's garden. And so I started looking up words in the Scots language dictionary for frost and ice. And when I did that, I saw words like crumshy, which is a sound that snow makes under feet.
I like that a lot.
Crumsh, crumsh, crumsh. And there's words like shockle, which is icicle, which makes sense, shockle. Words like skinkling, it's one of my favourite words, which is sparkling. And from reading those, they were like jewels in my mouth, and I had to write them down. I had to weave something with them. And that's when Nip Nebs was born.
Oot by in the shaddy of the pale moonlicht, the rakes about a canty wee sprit, wi' his cowl cowl breath, and his poke fu' skinkles, he garbs all things wi' a licksome prinkle.
Even as a little girl, you loved spending time outside in the garden, observing everything that was going on.
Aye, I loved it. I loved being in the garden. In fact, that kind of links to my latest book, Yum, where wee Jenny's out in the garden with a cheese and lettuce piece and three wee creatures, a craw, a moose and a hairy ubit, which is a caterpillar.
Well, a caterpillar, what a fabulous word.
And the caterpillar... When I discovered the name for a caterpillar, Hairy Ubit, I thought, oh, I've got to weave that into a story. It's so beautiful. So they come along and they basically hint very heavily for a bit of the cheese and lettuce piece. And, of course, she shares it with them. And it's a story for nursery wean, so it's really simple and awfully gentle.
You mentioned your papa a little earlier, and you went out on adventures with him, didn't you, exploring some of this beautiful landscape?
I was very lucky to have my papa till I was about the age of five. And up until that age, he would take us out, all of us. There was four kids. I've got three siblings, and I was the youngest. And my mum and my dad, there'd be seven of us piled into a Broon Reynolds estate, which features in my poem, The Root and Brig. And he would tuck us out to beautiful places. And one of my favourite places he would take us was the Root and Brig, which is just outside Dumfries. And it's this beautiful arched bridge. And if you're at the bottom by the river, there's this beautiful big stone that juts out from the forest edge. And then the arch of the brig, like, frames the waterfall. And it's the most perfect... Oh, it's just like a painting. It's just so beautiful. And every time we went there, I was so excited because I'm pretty sure there's fairies down there, because I'm sure I've seen them, and I think I still do see them when I get down there. I just turn into a little child again. Oh, I love it.
So you were inspired to write about that place?
Absolutely. We got a commission from the Tristan Thorne's poets. We got a commission from the Scottish Poetry Library to respond to Nan Shepherd. And Nan Shepherd wrote about nature, as you'll ken.
The living mountain.
The living mountain, indeed. Now, I'm no one for climbing mountains. I'm far too lazy and feared for that. I prefer to look at them from the bottom and go, oh, look at that, that's beautiful. And I admire folk that go up them. I think it's great, but it's just no for me. So I wasn't sure how I was going to connect with her work. I could appreciate it. But I pondered on the title, The Living Mountain, and that directly linked me to my papa and how he opened the doors to nature for me as a child, and that enchantment of nature that I still will come back to when I need it.
Scott Screever for Galloway, Susie Briggs, and you can hear a fabulous rendition of The Root and Brig and more from Susie in the Scotland Outdoors podcast, available now, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, she was a good great podcast. Fun, yeah. And I learnt lots of new words from her, actually, when I spent the afternoon with her. She manages to unearth some real crackers.
Hmm.
Now, time to reveal our mystery sound for this week. Let's have a final listen. It's a cracker.
It is a very good one, and we have three correct answers.
Go on, then.
Mary in St Andrews says, I think it is a humpback whale, a large baleen whale with a knobbly head and a beautiful song. Ross in Tainault also got it correct, and John McKenzie in Orkney says, is the mystery sound a humpback whale singing? Well, I don't know if it's singing, but definitely making a noise.
We definitely made it quite hard for you by removing any of kind of the water sound effects that you might hear.
Right.
And we got this courtesy of the Scottish Dolphin Centre, and you'll hear a bit more about humpback whales in the next few weeks.
Happens, maybe.
Yeah.
Dennis Forbes-Grattan says, wonderful programme today with great stories of the great River Devon, where I caught it. Rothy May, my largest ever fish, 31 pounds, but sadly it was over 40 years ago.
Oh, Leslie from Edinburgh has also been in touch. Good morning. May I take issue with Mark's assertion that golden eagles are quite light in weight? I have seen Mark, and in my eyes, yes, he's quite a big chap. Try holding an eagle on your arm when you're only 4 foot 7 and 7 stone.
The question is why? Why would you if you were only 4'7" and 7 stone?
Because it's a magical, fabulous experience, as Leslie says.
It is. Yeah, but certainly that's it from us this week. Please don't forget a new Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available today at noon. But from all the team here at BBC Aberdeen, sitting here in reasonable daylight.
I would say it's pretty light.
Pretty mild weather. Yeah. It's been pretty good. Thanks for listening.